From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, a Marquette researcher delves into the complicated science of gender and performance in sports.
We assume in a lot of our research when we test just men that what's relevant for men is relevant for women, but that's not always the case.
Then the bizarre story of a homemade submarine and an extortion plot in 1940s Milwaukee.
And how art therapists know that using art is helping their clients get through their mental health challenges.
They get better and they meet their goals. I mean, we have a treatment plan. Mm-hmm. It's not like we're just kind of pulling out the art supplies and sitting and making art. We have goals and it's very systematic.
Lake Effect comes your way next, but first, this news update.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It's Labor Day, and though the weather might be warm for a few more weeks, we think of it as the unofficial end to summer. So we're going to use today's show to take a look back at a few of the interviews we produced over the summer.
As the song says, anything you can do, I can do better.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. At least when it comes to the jobs we have.
But when it comes to sports performance, things are not equal. Men are generally stronger and faster than women thanks to their physiology. But there have been claims made over the years that the longer an event goes, think ultramarathon or even longer, the more advantages women have over men.
And there are documented cases where women do beat men in ultra-endurance events. But are those exceptions rather than the rule? Marquette University's Sandra Hunter has been studying sex differences in sports for more than two decades, long enough to compile a great deal of data. She joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to set the record straight.
In most sports that require power or some type of endurance, the best men will always outperform the best women. Certainly there's overlap that a lot of women can perform better than a lot of men, but overall the best men will outperform the best women. And the reason for that is that in terms of endurance, the maximal oxygen consumption and that capacity of men is much better than women, and usually about 10%. And the reason is basically because men have larger hearts, they have more muscle mass, they have more hemoglobin, which is that oxygen-carrying capacity of the blood, and they have less body fat to carry during certainly weight-bearing activities such as running. And so it's not surprising that you see around about a 10-12% difference in world records between men and women across the board, certainly in endurance events. Sometimes in events that require more power, sometimes those percentages can increase, but that's just the bottom line, and it's always going to make it difficult for women to outdo men.
Now, some growing number of recent standout performances by women in ultra-distant events has, I suppose, researchers, athletes, coach, believing that women maybe still aren't far from achieving the full potential as athletes. So you mentioned one thing is that women have more fat on their bodies, and mm-hmm. some people have said that this helps them in the extreme endurance runs to help fuel them or keep them going. And do women also have different muscle structure that allows their muscles to perform at a long, sustained rate compared to men going out hot and maybe losing steam?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there is this theory that women will outdo men, particularly at the very long events. And there is some credibility behind that, but we looked into that with some of the research we did. We looked at the sex differences in ultramarathon distances and many of the events across America. And we didn't find that to be true on average. You know, the reality is you get less women and less men competing in those events. So you get more of these anomalies that occur. And there's other factors that will contribute to performance during those really long races, particularly if it's hot or cold, that may have little to do with the physiology of that particular person, but, you know, some spurious event. But on that topic, I did say that men will outperform women. I've done a lot of research now over the last 20 years in showing that, in fact, women are less fatigable than men if you get them to perform a very particular exercise at the same intensity as a man's. For instance, we get subjects, both men and women, into the lab, and we've noted that the women will be able to outdo men if we ask them to perform a contraction at 20% of their maximum or 30% of their maximum for as long as possible. And so we find that for these very isolated cases of arm muscles, lower limb muscles, that certainly women will outperform women. And that really is reflective of the different makeup, which what you were alluding to before, of their muscles and the types of fibers that they have, and that a lot of the makeup of the fibers of women in particular are more fatigue resistant. Women on average have more fatigue resistant muscle fibers than men. And so this allows them to, under certain conditions at the same relative intensity, say 20% or 30%, to certainly be less fatigable than men. And sometimes it can be quite stark. And I've studied that for many years now, and we've looked at models as to why that occurs, but it's predominantly due to differences within the muscle.
Now, you yourself have been in the field studying these things, but there overall is a lack of female athletes being studied compared to men, as well as how long they've been studied for. I mean, for example, we couldn't officially run marathons until the 1970s. So how does this lack of data affect things now and going forward?
Yeah, that's a really good observation. So, and I think you're alluding to, say, for the marathon where women were only legally able to compete in the 1970s, which is... I just find that interesting and shocking at the same time.
Yeah.
But so there certainly hasn't been the same opportunity. And what we see in biomedical research in general as well is that there's a huge sex bias for less inclusion of women in biomedical research studies. And so as a result, it certainly puts us at risk of not understanding what the true sex differences are due to, say, physiology or anatomy, at least within the body. And that sort of goes over to diseases as well and truly understanding what diseases are.
Right. And on top of that, Title IX was implemented in the 70s, but many schools didn't feel the full effects until maybe 10, 20 years after. Some can argue
Correct.
Still today that things aren't being implemented equally. So has Title IX affected how men and women are studied in exercise as well, or in endurance sports?
I think it's been more of an awareness. There's a couple of reasons probably as to why women aren't studied as much, particularly in the exercise science that I've noted. A lot of the researchers were male to begin with, and over time that has changed, and that's certainly not always the case now. But also, there's a lot of male researchers who've come up to me, you know, in conferences and just said, I'm not comfortable with dealing with the menstrual cycle of women and it complicates things. So we just study men and we just study males. And
but does it really complicate things?
I don't think it does, not at all. And in fact, the research that we've done in my research lab has shown that, in fact, the differences across the menstrual cycle for a woman is that those differences are much less than the differences, say, between men and women, and that they're just small fluctuations and that they really have very limited effect on some of these more pertinent issues of, you know, strength and fatigability differences between men and women. And so I think it's more perception and that you know, we've just got to start including women more than men in a lot of these studies. With this sex differences research, it's been really interesting. There's really two approaches. One is to bring men and women into the research laboratory and to understand their physiology. There's no doubt women are less fatigable, but men are stronger and faster and more powerful. The other approach is to take real-world data, performance data, and then to try and understand the physiology based on that real-world data. And that's what economists do, that's what social scientists do. They take real-world data and try and understand it. And so about 10 years ago, a journalist from Runner's World called me up and asked me if there was, and this is how I really got into this, is there any sex difference in the age at which men and women peak in their marathon performance? And I said to her, I have no idea. And the reason she was asking, because in the Beijing Olympics, the woman who won was 38 years of age And the guy who won, the male, was 21. And there's this sort of perception out there that women may be older when they perform best at marathons. I said, I have no idea. So I got some undergrads and said, we can look at this. Let's go back and do some data mining now that there's a lot of results online and we can find a lot of information about the best runners. And I said, you've got to find their ages. And the top five runners who won these major marathons like the Boston, the New York, the Chicago, Berlin, the Olympics, the World Championships. And we also looked at the performances and we compared the best men to the best women. But on the ages and that age question, are men and women different in the ages at which they peak in their performance? The answer was no, they're not. In fact, they're about 29 years of age on average. There was a bit of a trend for women in the London Marathon and the Chicago Marathon to be a few years older as they won. But we put that down to the fact that those marathons are flatter. And if you're an older woman, you probably want to run a flatter marathon just because your power starts to go. I mean, it's the same with men, but that was what we hypothesised. But overall, there's very little age difference. But the most thrilling thing that came out of that first article and that first research study was that we compared the first male and the first female, the second male and the second female, and looked at the sex difference. And when you take the first, it was around about 11.5% difference, sex difference, which made sense. And these are the best runners in the world, and this was across about 30 years of data. But when you got out to the fifth person, the sex difference had increased to about 13%. I thought, well, why is that so? Why is the fifth best male and the fifth best female, why is the sex difference bigger here? So then we did another study and we looked at the New York Marathon data because we hypothesised that in fact it may be that there's less depth in the pool of runners within women because they haven't been competing as long, only since the 70s. And the interesting thing about the New York Marathon is that we're able to get age groups and we're able to get the numbers of men and women within age groups. And so we're able to look at these correlations between the ratio and the numbers of men and women within each age group and the sex difference. And we found a fantastic and really nice relationship between the number of men and women within an age group and the sex difference. And basically, the less women within an age group, the bigger the sex difference. And it explained about a third of the data. The other two-thirds of the data is explained by pure physiological differences. So I was sort of a bit gobsmacked. I thought, wow, can it be this simple? The talent pool is less because women just aren't competing at the same rate. The interesting thing in that data was that the 20 to the 29-year-olds, they did have a ratio of 1-to-1. And when we looked at that, their sex difference was about 11%. And so it showed me that, yeah, this is a real issue. Mm-hmm. If women aren't competing at the same rates and the participation is less, we really won't and don't understand the true physiological sex differences and what's relevant for women. And we assume in a lot of our research when we test just men that what's relevant for men is relevant for women. But that's not always the case. Particularly if exercise fatigability is different, if there's responses to training that may be different between men and women. So it's just fascinating. It's probably a window into a much bigger issue where if women are included less in research studies in general in biomedical science, that in fact we're not going to truly understand what the sex differences are and may miss some things, particularly with our research into drugs.
So there is the gap in participation, but do you think it's because, you know, are women less or more active than men today? And in addition to that, is it because of the old myth that women aren't competitive, that our nature of competitiveness is not strongly fueled as is compared to men, or their sense of, you know, competing with each other rather?
Yeah, there is that theory out there, and it's being fueled by a lot of research. But we looked into that because I did have a colleague who approached me and said, I think women are less competitive than men and that some of this sex difference is actually explained by the fact that women are less competitive and they're not trying as hard And I was shocked. In fact, when we...
Could you say this with a straight face?
So we do studies in my lab where we actually measure the ability of the brain to activate the muscle. And there's zip differences between men and women. That in fact, that women are equally motivated to perform maximal contractions just as much as men are. So there's that bit of evidence. But certainly with running events, there is the possibility that women are less competitive or less risk takers. That's what we rephrased it as. Are they less of a risk taker? Now, we collected some data over 14 marathons. It was about 91,000 data points. And we compared the pacing of men and women across these marathons. So we compared how fast men went out versus how fast women went out in the first half of the run versus the second half. And those who believe that women are less competitive than men would hypothesize that men are going to go out faster because they believe they can, they're more competitive, they're going to run faster, and then they're just going to slow more because in a marathon, sometimes that happens. You sort of hit a wall and it can be almost catastrophic in terms of performance. And that women will be more evenly paced. So, and that's exactly what we did find. We didn't find it in the elite women and men. We found that there was very little difference in pacing. But the alternative hypothesis is that women also have, they have a more robust ability to glycogen spare. And so it could be still a physiological difference. So to combat that, I said to him, well, let's study a distance where glycogen is not an issue, and that would be, say, the 10K race. So then we did another study where we looked at about 200,000 data points, and we found certainly that there was still a small sex difference in pacing, but it was mostly eradicated, and that, in fact, that the men and women did fairly similarly across the 10K race. So that proved to me that for at least this domain, certainly women and men have similar motivations. Now, why they do a marathon may be different, but their drive to win, their drive to compete, I think is not particularly different.
Dr. Sandra Hunter is a professor in Marquette University's exercise science program. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find out more about Dr. Hunter's research at WUWM.com.
A short break now, and then we get the unlikely story of a Milwaukee man's would-be extortion plan in the 1940s and why it went wrong. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. There's not much we can tell you about Walter Paul Minks that you won't hear in the next few minutes anyway. Minks was the not-quite mastermind behind a Milwaukee plot to make off with a fortune more than 70 years ago.
But unlike some of the notorious criminals of history, Minks was not fated to become the stuff of larcenous folklore. But his story does live on. It was featured in June's issue of Milwaukee Magazine, and we spoke with writer Matthew Prigge, and he explained more about our would-be criminal genius.
So Walter Minks was one of the strange characters I've come across in the work I do on Milwaukee's history. And back in 1940, he hatched this plan to extort a local businessman out of $100,000 and developed this very convoluted plot involving dynamite and airplanes and submarines to try to get away with the crime.
It sounds like something out of, you know, a crime novel or out of a film somehow.
Yeah, when I started getting into it, it felt a lot like a Coen Brothers movie with the weird plot and just how the interesting character of Minks himself and how he could be very brilliant in some areas and then pretty boneheaded in others.
That's an interesting comparison because I definitely thought of the Coen Brothers, in particular because so much of it goes wrong in a lot of ways. And even in the end, you go, well, nothing much really happened. And yet, like, it was such an intriguing story. So let's go back to Walter Minks himself. He comes to Wisconsin by way of Germany and comes with a lot of interesting ideas.
Yeah, he immigrated from Germany with his family. And here he became, he was an iron worker. And, you know, I write that he was very much a German at heart, but he had these American ambitions. And this is, again, 1940, so, you know, war is underway in Europe. And he's at once, he's very proud of his German heritage. He's fairly pro-Hitler. And on the other hand, he has these, you know, this American dream of building a business and making a name for himself. So it's an interesting, you know, not quite a contradiction, but he's, you know, it's just all part of this weird character.
It is an interesting dichotomy. I think the most interesting thing about his sort of before the plot is hatched is the submarine itself, which ends up being an integral part of the plot. But it, like so much of what he does, it kind of starts with a bang and then fizzles.
Yeah, he'd had this, well, he'd been building things since he was in his early teens. He said he had built a motorboat from scratch. He claimed to have actually built an airplane and flown it, which I found kind of hard to believe when I was doing this. But he, you know, he was always tinkering with something. He said he never read any of this in books. He just did it all from his own imagination. He had tried building a submarine earlier with the intent of, I guess, taking it overseas and looting sunken U-boats, but he didn't quite follow through on that. But yeah, he ended up building this submarine to play a role in this extortion plot. And the idea was that he was going to send an extortion letter to this man named Roland Davey, who was the general manager of the Sears stores here in Milwaukee, because he saw his picture in the newspaper and he looked like he might have money. So they picked him, you know, fairly at random. And the idea was that they would make him, that he would be the extortion money. The $100,000 would be dropped out of an airplane over Lake Michigan. And as the police and everybody else would be looking for some kind of motorboat or some craft on top of the water, he would be submerged. He would have there would be a light connected to a submarine that would indicate where the money should be dropped. And then when it was dropped, he'd surface and get it and then go back underneath and make the trip back to the beach where his car would be waiting, and he'd get away scot-free.
Solid,
which was the plan.
Solid plan. So what happens when he actually tries to do it?
The interesting thing about this is the building of the submarine was kind of an afterthought. They'd been planning this for months. He was going to sort of send this guy a message or let him know he was serious by detonating a pipe bomb in one of his stores, which he actually did. I mean, he spent far more time building the pipe bomb than he actually did the submarine. This submarine only took him about a week to build from his own design. And so I'll get to the submarine in a bit, but the first big thing that went wrong was when he delivered this ransom note, which indicated, you know, that it had warned that they were going to set off a bomb. This is before the bomb went off. They told him what they were going to do. They threatened him with death and the destruction of his stores if he did not follow through. They gave him the instructions, but it was delivered to the wrong house. Walter Minks had gotten, he thought he had this guy's address out of the telephone directory. It turned out he lived a few blocks away, and the, I guess, boneheaded part and dumb luck comes into this, too, when he delivers the note and he's seen delivering it by somebody who lives in the house, and the person who sees him is the daughter of, her father is a circuit court judge. So instead of delivering it to the store manager, he drops it on the front porch of a judge, and, of course, they immediately go to the police, and they're sort of onto this from the beginning. They still don't know who's behind it, but you know, they have that much of a head start on solving this case because he got the address wrong when he dropped off the ransom note.
So he's able to detonate the bomb. That was the next stop in this whole
plot.
That
happened the next day. And that's also interesting because after the note was delivered, the police were staking out all these stores, and he managed to walk in unnoticed and drop off that was hidden in an oil can. So he dropped it off in a secluded part of the store. And I think, you know, had he had any idea that police were around the area, he might have not been so casual and calm in walking in. But, yeah, he managed to walk in right underneath the nose of the police and set off this bomb, which kind of ramped it up another few notches on the law enforcement end, because if they had any thoughts that maybe this is just some crank, or if, you know, this wasn't serious, they, yeah, when the bomb went off, that pretty much wiped out all those ideas.
What I found perhaps most interesting is the next part of the plot. They're testing out the submarine. He hasn't tested out the submarine.
Right, right. Yeah, he's tested it to make sure it was watertight, but he hadn't actually taken it in the water, because he built it in his parents' backyard on Holton. Yeah, so him and his brother, who's involved in this as well, they go down to the beach off of Whitefish Bay. It's only big enough for one person, so Walter goes out in this thing, and he's designed this this faucet system that he can take on lake water and pour it into the keel, which would submerge it, and he's going through this process, and it's an hour passes, and then 2 hours pass, and he can't get the entire thing submerged because it's not heavy enough. And as he's doing this with his brother standing on the beach, people begin to see it's 10 o'clock at night or something, and but people walking past see what's going on, and they're curious, and they stop, and after a few hours, there's this crowd of people on the beach watching them try to submerge this submarine. And because the beaches are closed at night, eventually some Shorewood police officers show up. And they, you know, they come up with a story about how they're, which is half true, that they built this thing and they wanted to see if it could submerge. But that rattles both of them pretty badly. And they go home. They leave the submarine at the beach hidden in some bushes because they can't even worry about that right now. And they don't. And at his house or at the Timmerman Field, or what is now Timmerman Field, Davey and the police are waiting for the call that's going to tell them where they're going to go. And the two Minx brothers are so shaken by this that they don't even bother to contact them. They just go home, and they realize that the submarine thing isn't going to work because the submarine they built doesn't submerge all the way.
So they switch tactics.
Yes. Now they come up with this idea that they're going to have this money in a bag that somebody on the store manager, he needs to find somebody to drive, to get on a motorcycle, and they're going to give him instructions. You know, he gets instructions to take him to one corner, and there he finds a note that gives him instructions to go to some other corner, and it's this very roundabout, you know, he's driving all over the north side. Of course, the police are following close behind him. The guy on the motorcycle is a police officer. He's carrying a bag filled with blank paper slips, because this entire thing is, at this point, is busted. The Minx brothers don't know this yet. And they get to the end of all these instructions, and they're supposed to leave what's supposed to be the money behind this billboard in an empty lot. And the police are camped out all around it, waiting for somebody to pick it up. And at this point, Walter Minx he just gets kind of bored with it, I guess. It's sort of hard to explain, but at the end, he drives to the scene, he circles it a few times, and decides not to go and get the money.
Which to me is maybe perhaps the most Coen Brothers-esque ending to this story.
Yeah. Possible. At the end, I got the impression he was more interested to see if he could pull this off than getting the money. He admitted afterwards that he was thinking, like, well, maybe I should, instead of $100,000, maybe I'll just ask for $1,000 just to kind of recoup my losses in all this. Or I'll just call up the guy and tell him it's off. He loses interest in the financial end of it, but he's still interested to see if he can actually make this happen, if he can make somebody leave this money behind a billboard.
And yet he's still on the hook for the crime.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He goes home after he doesn't pick up the money. And at this point, the police, when they looked at the pipe bomb that was detonated, there were certain elements to the design of that indicated somebody with knowledge of ironworking might have been involved. So, you know, they do the shoe leather thing. They talked to the people at the store. They said, well, you've had any ironwork done here lately? And they did. And they went to the firm that had this ironwork done, and they talked to the people who worked on the job. And there's one person who worked on the job who's no longer with the firm, and of course that's Walter Minx, and he's branched off. What he wanted the money for was to start his own ironworking business, to invest in all this equipment he needed. He had been doing it on his own, but he hadn't been making much money at it. And actually, just before all this, he'd been evicted from the shop he was renting. So they go to his shop, and after he was evicted, he just left everything behind. So they go there and they literally find all the stuff that went into making this pipe bomb that was still left behind, and this just coincides with him not going to pick up the money. So the morning After the money, or the what should have been the money, is dropped, he's arrested at his house for his involvement in this.
So I think the running theme in the piece is that he's a very smart man who makes a lot of foolish mistakes.
Yeah. As he was working, you know, he used all the stock of equipment, or the stock of, you know, goods, materials he used in his normal work he made with the bomb. So again, as soon as they swept through the shop, they found out all these pieces that matched up with what were in the bomb. And when he was arrested, they had he went into this room where they had all the pieces laid out, and they said, well, this is what we found in your shop. This is what that pipe bomb was made out of, like hoping, you know, to present him with enough that he would kind of, you know, he couldn't talk his way out of it. And he just started admitting to everything. He explained every part of the story to the police and did so proudly. He was really proud of what everything he'd done, that he'd, you know, built this submarine and concocted this whole plot. And especially when the newspapers found out, he actually, there was a sketch of the submarine that appeared in the Milwaukee Journal, and he helped the sketch artist to, he's like, oh, you missed this valve here, so this needs to go in here. And he wanted to make sure that people knew how smart he was and how he was able to build this thing in a week. And, you know, he, of course, downplayed the more questionable decisions he made in this whole plot, but he was... They described him standing next to the submarine like a proud father.
So he does get convicted.
Yeah, he pleads guilty. He actually tries, if there's, you know, one noble thing he does during all this, he tries to take the fall for the whole thing. He says there was actually a third, his brother-in-law was involved in this sort of early on and didn't really have anything to do with the execution of it and backed out halfway through. So the brother-in-law wasn't actually charged, but they did try to charge his brother, and Walter tried to take the blame for the whole thing, or maybe take credit for the whole thing. I don't know. But so that didn't, you know, that didn't play. He pled guilty. His brother pled not guilty. They're both convicted. And I think they got 12 and 14 years, his brother and Walter, in the crime.
They didn't quite serve that long, it seems.
No, I'm not actually sure when his brother got out, but yeah, Walter ended up serving 6 years in jail. And sort of, you know, he kept, a few times during that term when his name would pop up in the newspapers. The first time was he wanted to work in a munitions plant, which prisoners did then. Of course, now the U.S. is involved in the war by this time. And he made this show of, you know, renouncing his Nazi past and renouncing Hitler and saying that he wanted to, you know, help the American war effort. I don't think they gave him that post. And then a few years later, he escaped from prison by essentially just, it was a low security prison. He just, you know, walked out an unmarked or an unguarded door, and he was gone for a few hours. And then I think he turned himself back in, or they picked him up with no resistance. But yeah, and after 6 years, he was freed.
And yet he lived the rest of his life being the man who tried to extort.
Yeah, he, as far as I know, as far as everything I've been able to tell, after he got out of prison, he lived an upstanding life. He was actually, and I didn't include this in the article just for spaces, just for the sake of space, but he was a very early NASCAR driver as well in the late 40s. He was one of the first people to get involved in that.
Well, there we are. Matthew Prigge, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always good to be here.
Writer Matthew Prigge's article about Walter Paul Minks and his homemade submarine was in the June issue of Milwaukee Magazine.
One more quick break, and then we'll travel across town to Bayview, one of the centers of the growing art therapy world in Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today, we're listening back to a few of the interviews we produced over the summer.
For people living with mental illness, trauma, or other difficult life circumstances, there are many different forms of therapy that professional counselors can use to help. Psychotherapy and other talk therapy techniques have been well used and accepted for more than 100 years.
But it has been much more recently that art therapy has come into its own in this country and taken its place among other more long-standing practices. There's an increasing number of art therapists practicing in Milwaukee, largely thanks to a growing program at Mount Mary University.
Five Milwaukee art therapists work out of a recently renovated space on South KK Avenue in Bayview. Bloom Center for Art and Integrated Therapies is headed by Emily Nolan, who was in the first doctoral class to come out of Mount Mary's program. We stopped by the studio on a recent Monday before any patients were there and spoke with Nolan and fellow therapists Ashley Smallwood and Caitlin Walsh. Thanks for having me here.
Lovely to have you.
Welcome to Bloom. Thank you.
Well, so before we really get into what you do with your clients, I'm curious to have both of you kind of reflect on your life as an artist and why you feel a connection between art and helping people through what you help people through.
Well, I'll start with that. I fell in love with photography at a really young age, and I also, growing up, had a neighbor who was diagnosed with autism, and I started working with him when I was probably, I think, in seventh grade, volunteering. We were repatterning his brain, and I fell in love with the ability to, you know, spend time helping people that needed it. And he had no verbal communication, so it was often things like letter boards or computer screens or...
So you were not doing art therapy with him at that point?
Not at that time, no, but I was really drawn to the ability to help people. And again, not having verbal skills, you needed another outlet to do that. So as I got older, I got my degree in fine arts, and then from there kind of got lost on what to do and found art therapy and literally fell in love with the idea that you can connect art making, which was my background, with the ability to help people. So that's where it kind of blossomed for me, and that was probably 10 years ago that I found that. So I'm new to the field.
I was in a totally different career field until my late 20s. And
what were you doing?
I actually owned a shop on the east side, a knitting store, so it was still creative. I always had this feeling that I'd be a good therapist. And my mother was a therapist, and she kind of talked to me about what a long road it is, because it's really a long road. She just wanted to be real with me, not that I wouldn't be good at it. I think she always knew that. So I found the art therapy and I was like, oh my gosh. It was like a light bulb moment that all my credits would transfer, everything was great, and I was an artist. And yeah, so it has been a long road. It's been wonderful. I think I feel lucky every day to come, and my clients have been great.
Well, and I gather the way this field works, there are a lot of people who are new to the field. What do we understand about this field today that 100 years ago or 50 years ago or 30 years ago that we didn't?
I think it's exactly what Ashley just said, in that it is able to help people in ways that traditional models of counseling or therapies would normally help. Yeah.
Okay, well, so we're in the studio, and can you kind of describe the space we are and really what happens here?
Sure. Right now, we're sitting in what is the community area, and this is a place where we invite the public in once a week to create art with art therapy interns that we have here on staff or volunteer art therapists who staff the space.
As in, people are here for non-therapeutic reasons or therapeutic reasons that they don't have to necessarily get into? Or
yeah, therapeutic reasons that they don't necessarily have to disclose, and they don't need a diagnosis to be able to join in on that particular experience. And so it's an opportunity for the general public to engage in art therapy. And it goes beyond just that. In some ways, therapy in general, lots of different therapies, treatment of any kind is very privileged a lot of times to people who have insurance or who have jobs who can pay the out-of-pocket fees for those things. And so part of what Bloom's mission is to be able to provide opportunities to engage in art therapy for everybody.
So this is the community room. There are a number of smaller rooms that go off of this space.
Yeah, in those rooms, we typically do individual, family, small group, private sessions. And we have four different therapists here who see people all throughout the week in those sessions. And people pay out of pocket, they pay through their insurance. And we're also very excited to start working with Wraparound Care in Milwaukee.
How does someone know, you know, someone who's dealing with something, whether it's a mental illness issue or trauma or some other issue that would bring them to a therapist, that art is an appropriate and would be a useful part of the therapy for them?
I think some people know and some people don't know. I think some people seek us out. I'm finding that more and more people seek us out because they have heard of art therapy. They go online, they look up what's available in Milwaukee, and they come upon us. And so more and more referrals are coming for that specifically because they already know that they enjoy it. But what I've also seen is that, especially as I began my practice 15 years ago, that people came, and when we built a trusting relationship and I would ask them to do something creatively, they realized it got them out of their thinking brain and more into just allowing things to happen and seeing things visually. And so it was a different way of thinking, and it allowed them to access more things that maybe were guarded or that just weren't even available to them.
Is this the same thing or something different than the idea of mindfulness, say?
I think it's very similar to mindfulness, actually. I think that it's mindfulness in a different way. And there was actually an article that I just posted on Bloom's website or Facebook page about how art making is like meditating. And I think that from what I know of being a therapist and an art therapist, a lot of what we're doing is helping people create awareness, and it's the means or the approach that you do that with that changes.
You have to be open. You know, a lot of people sometimes when they hear art therapy have no idea what it is. So they're like thinking either we're an art teacher or that you're going to draw a picture and we're going to tell you what's wrong with you. And that is absolutely not what it is. So the people that walk in the door have to be open to, you know, being vulnerable and trying these new things. And that's why it's so important for us as clinicians to, like, you know, create that safe environment. Like Emily said, it is almost a form of mindfulness. Like when you get into the zone of making art, this happens almost on a daily basis in my office. All of a sudden, I'll look up at the clock and say, holy cow, that was already 45. Like, we got to clean up. And the kids always say, that went so fast. Like, I didn't even realize that our time was done. So I think that that kind of speaks to that, you know, being in like kind of a Zen moment where you lose everything and everything gets poured onto whatever you're creating at that time.
So let me ask you this. I mean, you know, you look in your office and you've got art supplies and a table covered in brown paper where people are presumably doing art, and you also have a comfortable chair and a comfortable couch. How do you go from, you know, I'm dealing with X to let's make art?
Yeah, so a lot of times what happens for me is that the client will come in and will initially sit down. And a lot of times I've realized that the kids go and they sit right at the table because they're ready to make art. But a lot of times the adults will come in and they'll sit on the couch and I'll sit in the chair and I'll just say, so tell me what's gone on with you since we've seen each other last. And we'll have us what I call a check-in. And during that time, I'm assessing what's going on with the client and what might be helpful to do in this moment. And so then I'm also thinking about, okay, so what art task can I give this particular person that's going to help them right now? But then also thinking about what our long-term goals are and the goals that we, myself and the client, have created together. At that point, I'll say, okay, so this is what I'm thinking. And I'll give the client a choice and say, is that something you're interested in doing? Let's move over to the table. And then we'll move over to the table and we'll start creating whatever it is. And I sometimes will join and sometimes I will watch, depending on sort of what the client needs at that time.
Sometimes you'll join, meaning?
I'll make art too, yeah.
It almost sounds like you have, for lack of a better term, a matrix in your head.
For me, yeah, my brain really works that way. I'm sort of ruling things out as we're going and talking about them, and I'm very systematic and very much like, okay, so, but then also too, there's an intuitive side of it as well, but that's intuitive with clinical knowledge. And so when I'm making art next to the client too, I'm making art for the client.
you know, one of our biggest talents or whatever you want to call it is being able to be flexible. And so, you know, sometimes you'll have maybe an art directive or specific material set out of things that, hey, I thought this would work. This would be a good thing to do with this client. But when they come in, they're going to tell you exactly what they need. So, I mean, sometimes they'll verbally just say, like, I need to sit down and talk to you. Or sometimes their actions will show this isn't exactly what we should be doing today.
Help me understand, when you are making art alongside the clients and you're making it for the client, how are they using what you are making?
I have an example actually in the other room, and I can talk about this experience with a client. So I had a client who, mostly nonverbal, had experienced severe sexual abuse as a young kid, and I had seen him for years, and he was still very, very nonverbal, and it was very difficult to get him to talk. Not that he couldn't talk, it was just not something he did. And so he had painted a picture with some stencils and of a tree. And as I was painting with him, I was painting a portion of the tree. And when it came to the end of the session and we were finished, and we always put up our paintings side by side and look at them together up on the board that we have. And I said, well, you know, what do you think? And he usually nodded, you know, he would nod and say, oh, yeah, it's good. I would say, well, you know, I'm going to tell you about my picture. I said, this is a picture of a part of a tree. And this is me wanting to be a part and to be let into where your branches are and to be a part of this. And it was kind of like building that trust with him. Hey, I'm safe. I want to be a part of this, and I'm here, and I'm here with you.
Do each of you recognize the therapeutic nature when you're making art yourself, for yourself?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Not to put too fine a point on it.
No, yes. I actually, in my bag, have my visual journals, and I keep them with me pretty much at all times. I do, and I recognize that when I have an overwhelming feeling or I'm dealing with something, the thing that I need to do absolutely the most is to go through and make my own art. Yeah.
Are there times as art therapists and professional counselors that you take a step back and say, maybe art isn't the best output or isn't the best way to get at these issues you're going through?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's my personal belief that the client can sort of lead me in where they want to go. Sometimes I can tell that they need to be pushed a little bit, and then if they're resistant to art, sometimes I can tell that it would be really helpful, and I'll try to get them maybe more interested in it. But I never force. It's not, at least for me, it's not a requirement.
There's no, you will do a watercolor and it will be good for you.
No, not at all. That's not my style. I'm not forceful in that way. Not at all.
How do you know that you have done this right? How do you know that you've been able to help someone?
They keep coming back. They get better. And they meet their goals. I mean, we have a treatment plan. Mm-hmm. It's not like we're just,
right,
you know, kind of pulling out the art supplies and sitting and making art. We have goals, and it's very systematic.
I have a client who came for art therapy and was very hesitant. So there's ways that we can see that she's expanding and growing. Like, she would work on really small pieces of paper at first. She was super nervous about what it was going to look like and how to use the materials. And she just came in last week and wanted to use huge paper. We were doing all new materials. She was like super into it. And there was no hesitation there at all. And she was able to notice that she wasn't judging herself. She wasn't being negative. She was super open to the process. And she told me this whole story about how she was with a bunch of friends and they were doing this group kind of like, oh, making onesies for babies, you know, at a little shower or something. And she was like, I was like leading everybody. I was totally utilizing all those things that we've talked about to not judge myself, not worry too much, to go with the process. So you can see through the actual art materials alongside of the treatment goals that we've set for them, which are much more like clinically worded than, oh, she's using larger paper. But even that is something that we would notice and assess and be like, oh, you can You're not trying to control everything so much. It doesn't have to be this tiny piece of paper and really rigid.
She felt some freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I imagine that you hear sometimes from skeptics, or you could understand how someone would say, well, how do you know that they're doing art is helping them any more than had they just gone through more traditional forms of therapy alone? But it sounds like there's a way to quantify the impact of the art alongside the other treatment plan.
So yeah, there are assessments that we can give, and we do have art-based assessments. And then we also have at our disposal any other psychological assessments that we can give if we've been trained or needed to be trained in those things. But because we're a new field, part of the difficulty though is that a lot of research hasn't been published necessarily. We can tell you, and we can have lots of clients tell you that they have been successful using art therapy, but there's a lack of research in some ways that shows quantifiably.
So then there's my question for you as someone who teaches this now and who has doctor in front of her name, what areas does the research need to go for this field to keep expanding?
There's a lot of different psychological theory approaches that are integrated with the art and art therapy. And I think the direction that we're moving towards and that my research goes in the direction of is trying to create a unified theory of art therapy and really understanding what happens, what are the phenomenological things that happen. And so my research right now is about, okay, so this isn't a private practice and it isn't an art studio, it's an art therapy studio. So this is what I call a liminal space. And so in that liminal space, what happens in it?
Does the reality of this work gel with what you were hoping when you decided to combine your interest in art and your interest in helping people?
It's even better than I imagined. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think for me, working a lot with kids is really rewarding, and you know, having them walk in and be excited to come to therapy at 6, 7 years old is makes me feel like something right's going on in there, you know. And essentially you're giving them all these different tools that they can use and transform to their own for the rest of their life, and that's pretty cool.
You have all these like aha moments and just great moments with your clients where you can see that things are clicking and they're getting things and they're moving forward. And of course there's hard days too, and sometimes you feel like it's sort of a thankless job at times, but overall you feel that you're helping people and that they're making some progress in their life, and that's incredibly rewarding for sure.
Well, thank you to all three of you. Best of luck in your work.
Thank you. It was nice to talk with you.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Nice meeting you.
Thanks so much for being here, Mitch.
Emily Nolan, Ashley Smallwood, and Caitlin Walsh are all art therapists at Bloom Center for Art and Integrated Therapies in Bayview. You can see photos from their studio at WUWM.com. And that's Monday's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We hope you enjoyed listening back to some of our interviews from this summer.
Thanks so much for tuning in today. And please be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.